introduce John before he comes up. I want to share what I got from his bio from online. I hope it's all accurate and correct, John. But I don't know how much all of us are familiar with John. Obviously, he has written a couple of books, and I know from my conversations with him, which have been very brief, just getting to know him, just had dinner with him, and again, we're so thankful that he made the trek and journey to come up here. He's going to be traveling around for the next week, speaking in various places at churches and such on this issue of social justice and Christianity and what we really need to know about it, which is such a pertinent issue for our time and our day. And we have to understand, we can't ignore it, right? It is all, it's pervasive in our culture, and we need to understand as followers of Christ what the Word of God says about it and how we are to address it in the church. We can't hide from this stuff. And so I'm thankful that someone like John is picking up the mantle and taking it upon himself to inform people about what's going on and how we can understand the history and the philosophy and the theories of social justice and, again, what God's Word has to say about it. From John's bio, John is a committed Christian. He loves the Lord, and he enjoys outdoor sports and music. He hails from New York, where I think he enjoys hiking and hunting a little bit as well. He repented of his sins and put his trust in the grace of Jesus Christ for full and immediate forgiveness as a child. And when he's not hiking or playing guitar, John writes about political and theological issues confronting the church. He has an MDiv from Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary and an MA in history from Liberty University. He was interested in political theory from a young age, but sensed a stronger desire for ministry. And during his college years, John worked in campus ministry and also served as a minister of music at his church. So let's all give John a warm welcome as he comes up here to share with us. John.
Well, thank you so much for coming out tonight. It is certainly a blessing to be here, and I very much enjoyed hearing you sing and singing one of my favorite hymns, The Church is One Foundation. It's not often I get to hear traditional piano with voices singing, and I love it. That's kind of the way I grew up. You have a wonderful pastor here in Pastor Michael, and I just want to say I know just from firsthand experience, it takes a lot of bravery to have someone like myself come out or even to talk about this. This is something that a lot of churches are afraid it'll cause a split, or you know, some people are going to leave the church or get mad or withhold their giving or something like that. So let's just kind of sidestep it. But you have a brave pastor, and I just want to commend those who go to this church for having him here and supporting him and just being here also yourselves tonight. So we are going to talk about the topic of social justice and Christianity. Of course, this is something that's maybe not a lot of us were aware of it, but last year I think we all became somewhat aware of it. And I was just talking to some brothers here in the front. It's amazing that a year ago, everything seemed that the whole media narrative, people were at each other's throats because of Black Lives Matter and what happened, a series of police incidences that happened. And this year, it seems like it's all shifted. That happened. That's done. We don't care about BLM anymore. Now it's all vaccines and COVID and all of that. So it's just amazing how fast things go. But there's something that connects the two. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit as we go through this. My goal is to give you, there's going to be a lot of information, but I want to give you a solid foundation for understanding what social justice is. So you got to know what you're dealing with. It's kind of like if you were living in Utah or living in a Muslim country and you didn't understand Mormonism or you didn't understand Islam. It's important as a Christian to understand the context in which we live. That's how you understand how to navigate discussions, how to witness. So, and you also know what challenges are going to arise. And so that's the first thing, is I want everyone to be able to understand basically what social justice is, so they can see what it does, the goals that it has, And then, of course, where it contradicts the Word of God and what we believe as Christians. And I'm not going to go deep in depth in particular passages unless someone has a question afterward. I'll do what I can if there's a question on a passage. But I'm going to give you kind of just a very broad overview. Here's what the Bible teaches. Here's what social justice teaches. Here's where they conflict. And hopefully, as a third thing that I'd like to get across is what we can do about this. And so some practical things in our own communities that we can do. And that's, of course, been a difficult thing, I think. Many of us feel powerless. We've been kicked off social media. Well, I've been kicked off some social media. Not all of us have. So what can we do now that, you know, we live in a different world than we did even a year and a half ago? So a little bit of a background on me. I know that Pastor already gave an introduction, so you know a little bit about who I am. Let me tell you about why I'm here speaking on this topic, though, and why it's important to me for Christians to be educated about this. I graduated from seminary in 2018 or I think it was early 2019 when I finally got my diploma, but I finished courses in 2018. And while I was there on the campus of Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, that's where I got my MDiv, I saw what really shocked me. I had been in secular academia, and I had seen Marxism. I had professors who said that, you know, I'm a Marxist. I mean, that's kind of how it is. But I wasn't expecting what I saw at my own seminary, which I thought was a very conservative Christian seminary, in about probably 2017, right after Donald Trump was elected. It's like someone flipped a switch. And all of a sudden, at the seminary I attended, social justice became the main thing on campus that the seminary wanted to focus on, whether it was articles, they had a think tank there, so the think tank was putting out material, chapel speakers, events that they would host, whatever it was, even in class discussions, social justice became such a pervasive topic. And it was really strange to me. I'll give you a few examples. There were three statements against either Donald Trump or the alt-right that either originated in or were heavily supported by faculty and administration at the seminary I went to in one semester. 8 years of Obama, there had been nothing. But in one semester after Donald Trump was elected, three statements that were supported on campus. And I thought, this is really strange. There were all kinds of things said in chapels and in articles that came out of the seminary challenging white privilege and historical monuments and the idea that we should have a sealed off border, you know, very friendly to open borders and these kinds of things. And the list goes on. And this was, it took me by surprise how fast this happened. I'm sure many of you can relate to that in the organizations that perhaps you work for or ministries which some of you might be involved with. I was shocked, and I remember I won't go into all the details. I have a lot of stories from this time, but I ended up going to a professor of mine who we kind of had to almost speak in coded language to figure out if someone was a political conservative. And I kind of got some hints that he had dropped, and I thought in class, I think he's a conservative. Like, it's kind of like drawing that proverbial ichthys fish in the Roman Empire. Like, that's a Christian, you know, I can go talk to them. So I went to his office, and I remember I said, look, I got to talk to you about what's happening on campus. And he goes, shut the door. It's okay, so shut the door. Like, I thought you were going to comfort me and tell me everything's going to be okay. But he didn't. I sat down, and he said, listen, if I were to say what I really think about what's going on, I would be fired in a heartbeat. He had been there probably over a decade. They needed him for the particular program that that he was involved in. And he proceeded to tell me about other professors who disagreed but also would not say anything. And as a student, this was very confusing to me and very troubling to me because I felt helpless. You know, what can I do in this situation? But it showed me how intimidating this was. People were feeling threatened that if they stood up against this, that they would be in trouble. Well, I prayed about it after I graduated. Actually, I was still going to Southeastern when I was starting to pray about this. And I sought some wise counsel, and I decided I was going to basically whistleblow. I was going to talk about what was happening there. And my reasoning was, I would want to know that if I was attending there myself. If I could turn the clock back, and this is what the seminary was like, and they're not telling people that on the front end, I would want to know. And they're not being honest. So I decided I'm going to go, and I'm gonna make a video. Now, I didn't have a following or anything like that. I decided I was going to grad school, and I wanted to have a little podcast to just outlet some of the things that I like to, you know, my wife doesn't want to hear me talk all day, so I figure I'll talk to a camera for a little bit, and maybe there's someone out there would want to hear, you know, my thoughts on hiking and outdoor stuff and also political things, and you know, no one was reading my blog, so I was like, I'll just, you know, instead of writing, I'll do a video thing. So I remember I did a podcast on hiking. I really love to hike. I love to be in the outdoors. And the next podcast, I thought, this is the one. I'm going to do one on the social justice movement at the seminary I was at. Well, I did not know that there was a conference. Some of you might have heard of the G3 conference. This was before it had started. I put this out there a week before the G3 conference. And they had a whole panel on social justice at this particular conference. Some of you might have seen that on YouTube. I was unaware of any of that. But apparently, somehow the video that I made went kind of mini viral, and everyone at that conference knew who I was when I showed up there. I had been invited, I went, and everyone knew who I was, and I was just shocked, and everyone said the same thing. It's happening where I am. I had emails and Facebook messages from all over the country. Keep going. It's happening where I am. I can't say anything. I'll be fired. People in the Southern Baptist Convention, people in other denominations. And it was very troubling to me. And that was what prodded me to continue doing that for another 3 weeks. So I'm 2.5 years later, and I'm still talking about it. And it just has picked up steam. It doesn't seem to be going away. And I thought there were going to be a lot more resources made and public figures coming out in Christianity and opposing this. And sadly, I was very mistaken about that. And so I decided to kind of reorient what I was doing, even for my graduate degree in history, and study the social justice movement in evangelicalism in particular. How did it get into evangelicalism? So there's two books in the back table. One of them is called Social Justice Goes to Church. That's the result of my study on how social justice got into evangelicalism. So if you want to understand the story, how did we get here, that's what that book's about. But and I realized Christians needed resources on this. We needed apologetics on this. And most of the apologists out there were still talking about atheism or other topics. And so the second book, which is called Christianity and Social Justice, is the result of that. And that one just came out. And both of them are back there. Afterward, if you'd like a copy, I am selling them for $20. I will autograph them. If you don't, if you can't pay $20, I'll just give one to you. I just want people to be able to have those resources if they need them, because we're going to need resources going forward. So that's a little bit about me, what prodded me to get involved in this, and I hope what I have to present to you today blesses you, and at the very least, I hope you leave here understanding better kind of the context in which you live. Just like if you were living in Utah in Mormon country, you understand how people think, what your kids or your young adults when they go off to college, what they're learning. Or high school now, to be honest, you will have a grasp on it, and you'll be able to understand what does the Bible say about some of these ideas. So what is modern social justice? That is hard to read, and it wasn't like that on my computer, but I will try to read this to you. The modern social justice movement is a repackaged configuration of egalitarian ideas heavily influenced over the past century by postmodern and Marxist derivatives. Its purpose is to rectify disparities in advantages between social groups through reallocation. That's great, John. What does that mean? Okay. The social justice movement is a movement that is focused on achieving a particular goal. They say equity, diversity, inclusion, so equality, some kind of an equality. And once we get there, we won't need a social justice movement anymore. But until we get there, we have so far to go, right? You hear that all the time. We have so far to go. We have to keep this struggle to get to this point of perfect equality. Now, this idea is not a new one, and we're going to talk about some figures from history that championed this and developed it. We are over 200 years in the future, past when the French Revolution happened and when some of these ideas were being mainstreamed in Europe. We are now looking back at centuries of development. And so I'm going to try to compact that as much as I can, but it's important to understand some of those developments so that you know kind of the context you live in today, where we are in the present. And again, the goal is achieving equality and then using some kind of mechanism for redistributing power or privilege or resources to achieve that goal, right? That's basically what it is. The first major thinker that I identify as a social justice thinker in the modern form, really it would be redistributive justice, would be maybe a more accurate term, is Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And he's credited with being one of the main philosophers behind the French Revolution. And Rousseau's teaching contained three major objectives that carry through the history of the social justice movement. And so we see this today, and we see this with any incarnation of the social justice movement throughout history, has these three elements. Number one, achieving an egalitarian ideal. Egalitarian is just the word equal in French. The reason we use the word egalitarian is because we're not talking about equality before the law. We're not talking about equal rights. We're talking about equal outcomes. We're talking specifically about a just society, quote unquote, in which no social group has an advantage over another social group. Everyone is even. There are no hierarchies at all. There's the relationships that exist, that are power disparities, are gone. Everyone has equal everything. So Jean-Jacques Rousseau wanted to achieve an egalitarian idea. Now, different people have different ideas about what that looks like, what's an equal society actually look like. But that's the goal. Number two, dismantling social institutions that prevent its achievement. So what's the problem? Why can't we get to utopia, to this great society where everything's equal? Well, because there's all these institutions around, don't you see? There's families. And families, they're passing down their resources and their land to their children. And this is so unjust. Their children get a benefit. Other children whose parents don't have land, they don't get that. And there's the church. And the church, you know, they of course hoard all kinds of money. And they get the peasants to give them money, and they steal it from them. And so the church is very unjust. Of course, you know, there's all kinds of businesses and corporations now, and these businesses are all unjust. And there's relationships, labor relationships, where you have either masters and slaves or employers and employees or some kind of a relationship where there's a boss telling laborers what to do. And that's, of course, unjust. And there's men and there's women and there's children and there's parents. And you can see how this goes on forever. There's always something that's unjust that's preventing the achievements of an egalitarian ideal. So the goal of social justice activists is take out the institutions or completely turn them around so that they are not the same as they were. Reform would be too gentle of a word, really revolutionize them so that they are now cranking out social justice rhetoric and they're part of the revolution. And then, of course, you need a force capable of executing this goal, this utopian dream. So in most cases, it's the government. There are some people that want the church to be in this place. The church is the one that's going to achieve the social justice ideal. You'll hear this a lot of the time from evangelicals who are on this train. Well, the government wouldn't have to do anything if the church would just achieve social justice. But most of the time, it's some kind of a government that can force people to do what they wouldn't normally do, to take their wealth, to give it to someone else, or to take their privilege or position or whatever the case may be. So those are the three, and this is very important, the three main objectives of social justice. Achieving an egalitarian ideal, dismantling social institutions that prevent its achievement, and implementing force capable of executing the utopian dream. Now, the next major figure that I think is worth noting is Karl Marx. Of course, everyone's heard of Karl Marx. During the socialist revolutions of 1848 in Europe, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels published the Communist Manifesto. And if you haven't read that, by the way, that probably would be a good thing at some point to read or to let your children know about. It's very short, so it doesn't take long to get through it. And there's a lot of things in there that I remember the first time I read it surprised me. For example, his ideas on the suburbs versus the city versus the country and trying to make things equal there. Or his ideas of, he didn't like marriage. Hey, who knew? I thought, you know, he was married, but he did not like marriage. He thought that was one of the ways that injustice was used against people. Well, wealth was maintained through this marital bond. So he published the Communist Manifesto, and he used something called conflict theory to explain economic disparities. That there's this conflict between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat, between the rich and the poor, for lack of a better term. And he called for mechanisms to abolish the bourgeois property through state control of credit, transportation, and production, as well as free public education. So here you see what I just talked about coming from Rousseau. It's the same kind of thing, only it's along economic lines. Things aren't equal in what sense, Karl Marx? Well, economically, they're not equal. So what are we going to do? Well, we need to have a central authority that's going to make things equal. And the state needs to control the means of production. That's how we're going to get there. And of course, some of these things we just take for granted, like free public education. Yeah, that's Karl Marx's idea. That wasn't something that Americans at that time believed at all. They were for, of course, local communities having schools and parents having control over what their children learned. But having a central authority mandate, that was totally foreign to them. So it shows how far we've come. Cultural Marxism is a little different than that. So Karl Marx, he thought everything's unjust because there's economic disparities. Some people have money, some people don't have money. Cultural Marxism drills down a little deeper. Antonio Gramsci, who was an Italian communist, believed classical Marxism was flawed in its assumption that the workers would inevitably revolt against the propertied class, since the workers believed loyalty to the propertied class benefited them. They failed to realize they were being controlled by values imposed on them through things like libraries, schools, voluntary associations, architecture, even street names, and of course, the church. In order to overturn this complex interdependent web of power, socialists needed to cease contenting themselves to operate within the values of the state and start criticizing the status quo, building their own hegemony, and wait for the collapse of the old order. What he's saying, and what he means by hegemony, is this complex web of things that control you without you knowing they control you. The cultural values you just accept because you were born into that culture. You open doors for people. You shake hands. You say yes, sir, and yes, ma'am. At least we do in Virginia. I just was in Virginia for a while. I think they say that up here, too. They don't say it in New York. But there's certain things that are attached to the culture that you lived in. You give honor and respect to certain people because of age or position or the fact that they're a veteran or a pastor. All these kinds of things are actually ways that you're being oppressed. You're being oppressed because you are under the thumb of this culture that is exerting its power over you, and you can't even see it. So it's so much deeper in Gramsci's mind than Marx ever even thought. Marx was just looking at money. He was just looking at the ledgers on an accounting book. Gramsci's saying you can't just look at money. You have to look at cultural values. Does white privilege start to make a little more sense now? Doesn't matter if you're poor, if you live in the Appalachians somewhere and in a cabin perhaps, and don't have running water, you still got white privilege. Gramsci's the one that started that kind of, at least gave us the logic to get to where we are now in thinking some of these things. Next came the Frankfurt School. And sorry that's washed out. In 1924, the Institute for Social Research, which came to be known as the Frankfurt School, started in Germany. At the inaugural address, the director, Karl Grunberg, announced that he saw Marxism not in terms of party politics, but rather as an ideologically driven research methodology. This research primarily focused not on the economic base, but rather the political and cultural superstructure of society. Members of the Frankfurt School, such as Max Horkheimer, Theodore Adorno, and Herbert Marcuse, drilled deep into culture using critical theory to identify specific ways in which consumers were oppressed by prevailing social forces. Any of you heard of critical race theory? Everyone's heard of it now, right? Donald Trump started talking about it, and then, of course, overnight it was the subject on every magazine cover. Critical race theory is kind of an offshoot of this. This predates it, but this is where critical theory started in the Frankfurt School, and it's really it's building on what Gramsci gave us in his prison notebooks. Those were the books that Gramsci wrote. He was in prison, and he wrote these cultural Marxist books, and the Frankfurt School carried on that cultural Marxism. Sometimes it's called neo-Marxism, other times critical theory is the word that's used, and it's really an academic pursuit by which academics, sociologists, historians, examine culture, and they try to drill down as deep as they possibly can to just find things in the culture that are oppressive, things you wouldn't even know, right? So Theodore Adorno had this thing called the F scale. Has anyone ever heard of the F scale? The F scale, F stands for fascist. The F scale is a scale that you use to determine how fascistic you are. And this became very popular in the late 60s, and universities all over the country started using the F scale for psychology. So you have a psychologist, and he has a patient come in, and he starts asking him questions. And he finds out, wow, this patient is really loyal to his parents. This patient, you know, she really submits to her husband. This patient really loves their culture that they live in and likes to honor their ancestors. Things like that were considered marks of fascism, that there's fascistic tendencies in someone who might exert some, I don't know, patriarchal dominance, or might love their parents a little too much, or might love the culture they're in or the nation they're part of. And of course, there are other things that we would be against, like abusive tendencies, but they put it under the umbrella of fascism. This was just like the Nazis. We're dealing with this today. There's different words that are used, but conservatives, generally, that have political conservative ideas, they're called a Nazi at some point. Why? They don't believe anything the Nazis believe. It's because of this kind of thinking. It's because of the critical theorists in the Frankfurt School, specifically Adorno and his F scale. People are looking for little tendencies that they can try to use to say that to pigeonhole someone into being a Nazi or a racist or whatever the flavor of the month that's unpopular to be is. Max Horkheimer did a lot of work on culture and as it pertained to media, to marketing, these kinds of things. You're being oppressed by the commercials that you view. Sometimes I feel like that, but for different reasons. So a commercial is selling you something that he says, you got to have this. And I don't need that, but it convinces you that you need it. And that's a form of oppression too. So there's all kinds of things that members of the Frankfurt School did to drill down deep into culture to find these connections to some kind of a bigotry or oppression. Herbert Marcuse is probably the best known member of the Frankfurt School. He is the one that is credited as being the father of the New Left. The New Left is the student radical movement in the 1960s, late 60s specifically. And Marcuse's thoughts, I don't know if you've ever heard the term long march through the institutions, that there's, you know, each institution's going to fall to Marxism one after one, and of course the church is the last one. That was basically Marcuse's idea. And political correctness traces back to Marcuse, this series of rules that you can or you should or shouldn't do, or things you can and can't say because of how it'll offend someone. That's all goes back to the Frankfurt School. And of course, any treatment of social justice would be incomplete without talking about postmodernism, radical subjectivity. And there's many figures I could have talked about here. I decided to narrow it down to two for this presentation. And I know it seems complicated. I'm trying to distill it and make it as simple as possible. But there's two French deconstructionists, postmodern thinkers, Jacques Derrida and Michel Foucault. Some people pronounce it Michel Foucault. And both of them had a great impact on today's critical theory. Critical race theory specifically. So let me give you a little introduction to them. Jacques Derrida believed meaning was not found in what was said, but rather by what was meant in accordance with the hegemony of language. Remember hegemony from Gramsci? Hegemony is this kind of interwoven network of cultural elements that seek to oppress you somehow. Well, he's saying that language is part of that. The very words we use, the sentences we compose, we can't escape it. We're always being oppressed or oppressing someone. And so using certain tools of analysis, many of which were inspired by Marx, Derrida endeavored to deconstruct messages in order to expose the prejudice embedded in them. What are your pronouns? I mean, it seems like a joke to us now. People who, though, read Jacques Derrida, it's not a joke to them. They think that our language is what determines reality. Male, female, I mean, come on. That's just the only reason we think there's males and females is because of the words we use. If we didn't use those words, we wouldn't think there's males and females. We could get past that disparity. Jacques Derrida is the one that gave us this kind of thing, or at least the tools to get there. Derrida stated himself that deconstruction was a radicalization of a certain Marxism, and its purpose was political. speech was political. What you said was political. Michel Foucault deconstructed knowledge by making it dependent on power. Have you ever heard knowledge is power? That's a very popular term. That's Foucault coming out. Foucault argued that modern ways of thinking, and by the way, I should say, not everyone who says knowledge is power is channeling Foucault. I'm just saying the phrase, and initially the reason it got popular was Foucault. Foucault argued that modern ways of thinking about things like insanity, disease, criminality, and sexuality were all motivated by an exercise in control and oppression. Institutions like hospitals and prisons developed to enforce the prevailing social knowledge. Foucault's teachings influenced today's post-colonial theory, feminism, and queer theory. So what's Foucault saying? Foucault is basically saying that everything around us is, if you could look at this room, let's say, and you could see it as it really is, what you would see is a bunch of ones and zeros representing power relationships. That's all there is. Whenever we say something, we are exerting power somehow. When we listen, someone's exerting power to us. When we take certain actions, we are exerting power. Going to your job is exerting power. Everything is power. And that's one of the key things to understand, to realize about today's social justice movement, is they look at everything and they see power. They see oppression and power. And Foucault is one of the main reasons for this. Now, I'm not going into the personal lives of some of these figures, but if you'll dive deep into some of them, you'll find rank immorality. And Foucault is probably one of the rankest. And there's a reason for that. So critical race theory, critical race theory and intersectionality. We're going to talk about these, and then we're going to switch gears a little bit and talk about Christianity and kind of what we see playing out in front of us right now in our time. But it's important we understand this stuff first. Derrick Bell is known as the father of critical race theory. He was a law professor at Harvard, and he believed that progress in American race relations is largely a mirage. So everything you see out there, that minorities can vote, they can exercise the same kinds of rights and privileges that people in quote-unquote majority culture exercise, that's all a mirage. None of it's true. They're still being just as oppressed. And the reason for that is that because whites continue, and sometimes even unconsciously, they don't know they're doing it, to maintain a dominion through things like white privilege. They give a certain privilege to some people and not to others, and they don't even realize they're doing it. The theory's basic teaching is that racism is systemically embedded within the fabric of society and can only be addressed by first interpreting the world through the lens of minority experience. So think about a prison. You might have prison guards, the administration that runs a prison. None of them are racists in the old definition of the word. None of them hate anyone because of their color of their skin or because they're different from them. Yet the whole prison system can be systemically racist because it's allocating privileges to certain people and not others. Or there's a disparity. There's a higher percentage of some people there than there are of other people that are there. That kind of thing. And so this is last year. This is what we saw last year. This kind of thinking going mainstream. It jumped out of the lab of the academy, and it got into the people took it to the streets. Intersectionality is related to critical race theory. It's a little different, though. One of Bell's students, Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, now she's still alive, developed intersectionality, which she said linked politics with postmodern theory. Crenshaw believed identity politics failed to take into account the existence of groups with more than one socially oppressed identity factor. She argued that someone who was a woman and a person of color needed unique political representation. So what she's saying is that, okay, we've come this far, we understand finally that there's this hegemony that's oppressing people, there's white privilege, some people can't get ahead, they can't get the same advantages. But we have to admit, there's different groups of disenfranchised people. You have women over here, they're disenfranchised because men are controlling them. Then you have minorities, racial minorities over here, and they're disenfranchised because the majority is somehow exerting a negative influence over them. And then you have LGBTQ people over here. And And now there's fat studies, and the list just goes on and on with the different kinds of identity groups, like introversion. Some people, I mean, I feel like a gluten allergy is now like, you know, it ranks you on the ladder somehow as being oppressed. And I can say that both my brothers have celiac, so nothing personal there. I probably do too, but I'm not willing to get the test because I don't want to give up, you know, going to Texas Roadhouse. So anyway, so intersectionality is this idea that there's some people that are uniquely oppressed. So you have some, like if you're a woman and you're a racial minority and you're a lesbian and you're left-handed, let's say, you are like really oppressed. You know, that's like the worst of the worst. And, you know, if your sports team's losing that year too, I guess you can add that into the mix or something, because you need political representation that's tailor-fit to you, because the feminists aren't going to represent you. They don't even know your needs. Neither are, you know, the other groups. You need someone that's going to uniquely look at your situation. So that's what intersectionality is. And what it does is it credits the person with the most oppression points as being the one most qualified to speak about oppression. Have you ever heard, you're white, you should just listen? Just shut up, just listen, you know? Or you're a man, you know, stop mansplaining to me. You know, you don't have the right to talk about this. I don't know, maybe they don't say those kinds of things out here. In more urban areas and in academic settings, you hear that all the time. I remember when I was at Liberty, I started a little club called the Patriarchy, you know, just a little informal thing among the students in my group. And we put up a poster on our office called the Patriarchy. And we had pictures of, this is so off topic, but we had pictures of like, you know, John Wayne and like Braveheart and one of the professors that looked really masculine and chiseled, we put him up there. And we were right across, though, from the only feminist in the department. It was ripped down the next day, so I never found out, but I think I know who did it. So that was my way of coping with that. But even in Christian universities, you hear that stuff all the time. So I just made a joke of it. But it's not a joke, especially if you're at a secular university. It is very serious, and you could get in very big trouble for doing what I did. And it wasn't just me. It was friends of mine, too. But intersectionality says that person who's got the most oppression is the only one that can speak. And there's assumptions behind this. There's something called standpoint epistemology, which is behind this as well, this postmodern idea that your oppression is what gives you this special knowledge into the insights into racism and all the hegemony, what's going on in culture that other people just can't see. And when you buy into this, you basically lose your voice. You can't object to anything the revolutionaries want to do, because they will always have someone that represents their oppressed, aggrieved class that forwards the revolution somehow. And if you disagree, if you're someone who says, hey, look, I'm African American, I'm a woman, I'm in an oppressed group, I disagree with your assessment, you lose your oppressed status at that point. So you have to be politically active on the left and have an oppressed status, and then you're an authority on the subject. It's basically what intersectionality is, and that's what it's done. And you have a whole group of people that believe this. Now, that's a lot to remember, and I don't expect everyone to remember all of that. If I just go back to the first slide and you just remember this, that social justice is about achieving an egalitarian ideal, dismantling social institutions that prevent its achievement, and implementing a force capable of executing utopia, you'll be on the right track. You'll understand, you'll be able to see what's going on and fit it into these categories. What's the goal of all this, though? This is where things become important. This is why I think many of you are here tonight. The goal is to destroy Orthodox Christianity. Now, it's more than that. The goal is to destroy the United States, to destroy the Western world, right? Ultimately, though, they're aiming for something higher. I guarantee it. They want to destroy Orthodox Christianity. Let me read you a few quotes from some of the main leaders in various social justice movements, some of the names you might recognize. Karl Marx: the social principles of Christianity preach the necessity of a ruling and oppressed class. They are cringing, but the proletariat is revolutionary. So Christianity, it's got to go. It's preventing the revolution from happening. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and this is an early feminist leader, had her own Bible, which she ripped out all the passages she didn't like that talked about male authority and those kinds of things. She said the strongest adverse influence to woman's elevation comes from the church, judging from its biblical expositions. A lot of conservatives today want to point back to the Seneca Falls Declaration, an early feminist movement, and I caution against it. If you go read the Seneca Falls Declaration, and you'll find some of the things that are said in that, like, for instance, marriage being slavery, that kind of thing, not exactly in keeping with Christianity. William Lloyd Garrison was an early radical abolitionist, immediate abolitionist. He said all reforms are anti-biblical. William Lloyd Garrison's also the one that said the Constitution was a deal with the devil. Antonio Gramsci, which we talked about, the hegemony and cultural Marxism, he wanted socialism to kill Christianity and replace any charitable relationship between the privileged and unprivileged with class solidarity and world domination. In other words, get rid of your Christian identity. And your identity needs to be with your class, with class solidarity. So the church is preventing this from happening. Michel Foucault desired to liberate people from political rationality, which he believed stood on the idea of Christian pastoral power. So do you think there's maybe a religion that they think is a problem that is preventing their revolution from taking place? Yeah, it's Christianity. It's us. It's the people in this room. So what's the second thing? What can they do? Well, they can replace Christianity. Jean-Jacques Rousseau said that Christian law was harmful to the constitution of a state. Instead, he imagined a religion that would one day make a revolution among men. Rather than biblical revelation, Rousseau based his new faith on the innate principle of justice and virtue. Rousseau stated, "I think that each will be judged not on what he believed, but on what he did." One observer pointed out, "This belief entails a great secularization by making morality, man's free moral action in this world, the highest thing." So he wanted to replace the church. Church is a problem. This traditional Orthodox Christianity thing is a problem. But maybe what we can do is we can have a new thing that's kind of like Christianity, but it's not Christianity. Herbert Marcuse from the Frankfurt School, father of the New Left, Long March of the Institutions, that guy. He believed religion inspired guilt in the present life, postponed human fulfillment in the afterlife, and reinforced the evil status quo, including some of the things from his day. He also held out hope that religion could be beneficial in transforming society if it became a heretical expression of a political attitude that protested prevailing standards with a practical message for here on earth. So now you're starting to see what happened last year. A lot of Christians have been praying for revival in this country. I'd like to suggest we had one last year, but it was a secular revival. You had people out there in large droves. You had religious rituals taking place. I'm going to show you some pictures of them. But it wasn't Orthodox Christianity. It was something different. But it looked a little bit like Orthodox Christianity. It was a counterfeit. And that's what Rousseau and Marcuse and a lot of these guys wanted. Derrick Bell, father of critical race theory, thought fundamentalist Christians divert political protests and reaffirm the conservative values on which the white middle classes' traditional illusions of superiority are grounded. Nevertheless, he also saw how a new interpretation of Christianity could lead to enlightenment instead of pacification. So he thinks, as many social justice activists today do, that, you know what? Let's ditch that old church thing, that Orthodox Christianity, that, you know, believing the Bible and every word it says. Let's get rid of that. Let's use this church as a political vehicle, though, for a new religion. And there's a lot of other quotes I could show you that I don't have time to show you today. H.G. Wells is one that's coming to my mind right now. He wanted, and he literally called it the New World Order. That's not a conspiracy thing. He literally called it that. That there would be a new religion. First he called it the Open Conspiracy and then the New World Order that would replace Christianity. And he was a Fabian socialist. So this has been going on for a long time. Now let's talk about last year. Here's some images from last year. From the BLM protests, you can see bottom left is some of you might have seen this video where there's a church and they're literally bowing down and praying to some BLM protesters, and they're apologizing to them for systemic racism and praying that God would forgive them. You have in the middle here, here's a journalist, Michael Tracy, says, and this is a secular journalist. He says, I'm telling you, every protest I've been to so far perfectly mirrors an outdoor evangelical Christian worship service. It's not a Christian who's saying that. And of course, there's many examples of it. So we saw what looked like something semi-Christian, semi-familiar to people who might have grown up with Christianity. I don't think it's an accident. Maybe some of you can relate to this. A lot of the people I know who are very hardcore social justice activists grew up in very conservative Christian homes. And when they go, one of them actually, I remember, it's a friend of my wife's, posted on Facebook that her church was to go out and engage in these kinds of protests. That was her church. So it's something familiar to them. And I like to suggest that's because it's a religion. That's because it's fulfilling, and there's parallels to Christianity, by the way. It's fulfilling all the needs a religion is supposed to fulfill. They have their own salvation. They have their own God. They have their own church. They have their own view of mankind. The bad news, of course, in their conception is that there's whiteness, not original sin, whiteness. Or you can, you know, pick whatever you want. It could be maleness or some other form of oppression. The divine law is political correctness. Some things you can say, some things you can't say. Some things you can do, some things you can't do. Judgment is getting canceled. It's a here on earth, in real time, judgment. And not only is it that you lose your job, you lose your reputation. And you're prevented from ever coming back into the public space in which you previously inhabited and worked. Now the good news, of course, if there is good news, is that you can become woke. Of being born again, and you understand all the oppression that's around you that you never saw before. And what you need to do once you become woke is you need to fulfill some sacraments. You need to take progressive political action. You need to try to further the revolution for equity, inclusion, and diversity. That's their version of heaven. Notice it's not afterlife, it's in this life. When it comes to the church, there isn't an organized church per se, but there is assembling, as I just showed you in those pictures. So there, activism is kind of parallel to that. Even if there's COVID restrictions everywhere and churches can't meet, you can still go and do activism, right? That means there's a special class. There's a special religious kind of recognition afforded to social justice activism that's not afforded to Christians. Evangelism would be implicit bias training on your job. When they come in and they have to talk to you for 3 days about how oppressive and horrible you are so that, you know, you don't cause a problem for HR. I mean, that's like sitting through, like, it's like a parallel of Christian evangelism. They're inculcating you into the beliefs of their religion. And of course, there's discipleship, which, and that could be implicit bias training too, this decolonization, this deconstruction of everything you believe. And it's this long process. Anyone know who Joshua Harris is? I'm not related to him, by the way. At least I don't think so. He went off the deep end about a year ago, maybe it was 2 years ago now, and I remember his post. He said that he used the word deconstruction. I'm deconstructing my faith. Meaning, piece by piece, he's figuring out where there were remnants of Christianity and he's trying to eradicate them. And then there is a hierarchy, whether they admit it or not. They're trying to get rid of all hierarchy because they want equality. But hierarchy is inescapable. You will never have a world without some kind of a hierarchy, meaning those who are above other people in a chain of command somewhere. So in their hierarchy, you have critical theorists, who are the prophets. You have the media, who serve as the priests. And you have community organizers or activists that serve as the clergy. And then, of course, I should note, you have the government, which basically the central authority, which controls everything. So they definitely have a hierarchy. There definitely is an acceptable power in their conception, whether they admit it or not. And when it comes to God or their ultimate authority, they look to social conflict theory, that there's this providence. We believe that God is the one, history is his story. He controls everything, the past, and he's bringing it towards a consummation. We just sang about it in our hymn, The Church is One Foundation. We await the consummation. They believe that there's this conflict going on between the haves and the have-nots, and they're fighting it out, and this is how history progresses itself. And so, I don't know if you remember when Barack Obama said, you didn't build that, you know, to a business owner. Well, that's how they can say that kind of thing. You know, you might have worked your whole life for something, but, you know, it's not really you. You're just basically the placeholder for what would have happened anyway because of forces outside of your control that are oppressing people and benefiting you. Their version of love is the revolution. I've noticed now since I put this together, love is, I guess, taking an experimental, I don't know how everyone feels about this, I'm just saying my mind, an experimental treatment for COVID. That's love. And if you don't do it, you're unloving. They use this to forward their own agenda, their own revolution. Justice is only achieved through the collective state. So once the state controls everything and has absolute control and can make things fair, that's when justice will happen. They have a press perspective as their inspiration. You're not allowed to challenge it. It's like the Bible. You can't challenge an oppressed perspective. They have woke books that serve as their canon, and they have social studies programs that serve as their seminaries. And lastly, mankind. The curse on humans is, it's not the world, the flesh, and the devil. It's systemic racism, white privilege, and white supremacists. Or you could say chauvinists, or whatever the flavor of the month happens to be. And the hope, if there is hope, is that intersectionality is going to be the engine by which social justice activists implement some kind of an egalitarian utopia. And of course, and then their saints, the ones they look to draw inspiration in this quest, are the victims. And we saw this all last year, repeating the final words of victims, getting into the position of victims when they died at the hands of the police. They're worshiping, they're venerating people as like their saints. And think about the Catholic Church. So I'm hoping that convinced you that most of the time when someone sees the parallels, it clicks for them. They say, wait a minute, this isn't just a political movement. This is a religion. We're not dealing with, this isn't Democrat politics. A lot of conservatives still think that, political conservatives. This is a spiritual war. And as Christians, we know the battle's not against flesh and blood. It's against angels, it's against principality, it's against powers. We know something that secular political conservatives don't know. We know who's behind this. We know why this is being deployed. And because we know that, it's our job to tell people that. This is actually a witnessing opportunity. Because you can put up Christianity over here against the social justice movement over here, and you can give non-believers all the alternatives. And I'm going to show you some of that in a moment. And if you're wondering, yes, I have tried to do this. I shouldn't say try, I have done this. I have gone to protests and I have talked to social justice activists and engaged them on this stuff. So here's the three steps, though. When someone, you've probably seen this, when someone gets woke or becomes a social justice activist, this is what they do. They get woke, they check their privilege, and then they shame others. These are like the three steps. And so that's the salvation experience all the way to the evangelism. And I've seen this in friends of mine. You've probably seen it in friends of yours. So it's a religion. Now, so what did Christians do? People in this room, we know that there's a spiritual battle going on. We can see that this is a religion. What did the leaders in our Christian denominations and institutions in the United States do, mostly? Not everyone did. There was a few exceptions. But mostly what they did was they decided that they were going to adopt social justice in a small increment. We're just taking a little bit of it. And we'll merge it with the Bible, and we'll make the social justice activists happy, and it'll be kind of like putting the blood on the door. The angel of death will pass us over. Thank you for ruining his business and not our church. And then we will avoid this. And we'll, you know, we'll do something along the lines of equity. We'll have a Sunday where we have a minority person or a couple come up, and they'll share their lived experience. You know, maybe we'll diversify our praise team or our elder board. We'll promote some books. I know that's what we'll do. We'll promote some books. Some churches did like reparations funds and these kinds of things. That's what we'll do because we want to be part of this cultural moment that's going on and at the same time try to hold on to the Bible. And we don't want anyone to be mad and we're going to keep our church together. Now, how well did that work? It's the church in America, it's in flames. I mean, the true church is there, but what we thought was the church is in flames right now. This has happened before. Most things in history do repeat themselves somewhere along the line. I'm not going to go into detail because of the sake of time, but I put on the screen just a few examples from history where Christians, or not, sometimes they're not Orthodox Christians, but something in the in the realm of Christendom, Christian teaching, biblical teaching, people who believe that to some extent, tried to merge what they believed with socialism or with social justice. And the latest woke church incarnation is just the latest incarnation. It's happened before. And in every single case it happens, it ends up destroying the church. Every single time. There's nothing left of the church by the time the church compromises on this. And they think it's just a political thing. They think it's just a little bit. And within a generation, why go to church anymore? What's the point? You can just get involved in the Democratic Party or something and probably do more good towards social justice in your mind than being part of your church. And if the church is so oppressive until 2 seconds ago, why would you want to be part of that? That's like the Klan saying, hey, we're diverse now, come join us. That's ridiculous. No one wants to do that. But that's what Christians are doing right now, our Christian leaders. They're trying to say, yeah, you know, everyone before us, they were a bunch of bigots. We're not. We're on board with the revolution. That brings us to social justice. And I've been using the word the whole time, and I'm going to tell you where it comes from now, because this is a big topic of debate. The term social justice was popularized, the way that we think of it now, was popularized not by someone in the secular world. It wasn't popularized by a political theorist. It wasn't Karl Marx. It was a man by the name of Walter Rauschenbusch. Now, the term had been around before him, but the term, and this is, I trace this all out in Christianity and Social Justice in the book that's back there. The term had been around, but it was Christians who were using the term, who wanted to promote socialism in their churches. They knew they couldn't use the word socialism because socialism was associated with immorality and atheism, and Christians didn't want anything to do with that. Atheism is wrong. Immorality, no thanks. We're not going to do the socialism thing. So instead, and it's very sneaky, they said, well, just use the term social justice. And Walter Rauschenbusch was the one who made this more popular than anyone else. He wrote a number of books on this, the early 20th century. And I'm just going to read for you a quote from him. He was a history professor, by the way, but he was a Christian. He claimed to be a Christian. And this is the social gospel movement. That's Rauschenbusch. But he used the term social justice. He said that powerful men frustrated the cause of social justice in order to hold their selfish social and economic privileges. It was therefore the job of Christians following Jesus' example to turn the energies of religion from the maintenance of conservative institutions to the support of movements for political emancipation and social justice. And of course, it hasn't, that's where we get the term. It hasn't changed since then. That's where we are. And this was a term that appealed to Christians. The mainline denominations, though, that accepted Rauschenbusch's teaching, they're dead now. They're all dead. Now, the teaching's coming to the evangelicals. So what's going to happen to the evangelicals? Same thing. They're going to die. Because this is a compromise on a number of levels. And for the sake of time, I'm not going to go all over this right now. Maybe in the question period we can. But social justice philosophy mirrors a number of ancient heresies. And I explain some of this in the book. I can explain it more later if someone's interested. But let's get to what you need to know. What do you need to know to fight social justice in the church? A basic knowledge of the gospel and a basic knowledge of the errors of Marxism and postmodernism. That's it. That's all you need to know. You don't have to have a PhD. You don't have to be a pastor. All you need to know is a little bit about the gospel and a little bit about Marxism and be able to see where the two contradict each other, and you can shine the light on it. What's the problem with social justice? I'm going to go through this briefly, and then I'll probably be some questions about it, I'm assuming. But Marxism, social justice, that whole panoply has a number of things that contradict the Christian religion. First of all, a different concept of truth. To social justice advocates today, truth is something that's subjective. It depends on your level of oppression. It depends on your lived experience. You're not allowed to tell someone what the truth is if you didn't have the same experience they had of oppression. So truth is not objective. Christians believe truth is objective. Truth is then subjective. They also have a different concept of reality itself. They look at the world and they see oppression everywhere. That's all they see sometimes. I mean, they could look at the McDonald's menu and see the three places there's racism on there or something. It's kind of like, you know, you ever watch those like CSI crime investigator shows where the guy walks into the room and he's looking for blood. You know, where did the murder happen? And he's got a special light that tells him where all the blood is. Well, social justice activists walk into the room and their light just has blood everywhere. It's just, you can't make sense of anything because everything is blood. Well, that's the way they look at power and oppression. Everything is power. Everything is oppression. And there's really no reality beyond that. There's no heaven. There's no eternal realm. Everything is just oppression and power. And they have a different concept, of course, of justice. Justice to them is not biblical justice. Biblical justice is equality before the law. The just man or the righteous man doesn't take a bribe, doesn't steal from other people. That's what it means to be equitable. You're applying the laws of God to everyone equally, no matter whether they're your brother, whether they're someone who's poor, whether they're someone you could take advantage of, whether they go to the fishing club with you. You're treating them the same because you want to honor God by applying his law the way it's supposed to be applied to everyone. Well, social justice doesn't see it that way. In fact, they want to blindfold Lady Justice. They want you to look very closely at someone's social location and their race and their all these external qualities and then make a determination. You may need to give more money to someone who's more oppressed. They have a different concept of sin. There's no forgiveness. You can't be forgiven because you have generational sin in you. You have the years and years of white privilege that you've benefited from. And there's nothing you can do to alleviate it because you can't change the color of your skin. That's not what the Bible says about sin. The Bible says that the fathers do not pay for the sins, or the sons do not pay for the sins of the fathers. They're held responsible for their own sin. They have a different concept of virtue. This is a little more complicated, but social justice activists actually see equality, diversity, and inclusion as virtues, and they're not virtues. The virtues are things like bravery, sacrifice, suffering for a greater cause. These are the kinds of things people build monuments to men for. Men who suffered great deprivation, or women who suffered great deprivation for their people, for their communities, for their churches, their families. That's what virtue is. Social justice advocates, though, they could honor a CEO, let's say, who is the most horrible person in his personal life and steals and cheats, but he supported the BLM movement, or he made a nice statement on social media about something social justice related. That's a different concept of virtue. It's not actual virtue, it's a fake virtue. And then the worst of all, they have a different gospel. Social justice activists combine in Christianity the gospel, the pure gospel of by grace through faith in Jesus Christ alone with social justice works. And that's why often you'll hear social justice activists in the church saying, if you're not forwarding the revolution, if you're not for BLM, you only have a half gospel. Because in their minds, there's some kind of a work righteousness that's required to be a Christian and to have the gospel. And that's, unfortunately, that's the Galatian heresy. That's combining law with grace. We are saved not because of what we've done or what we haven't done or anything in us. We are saved because of the grace of God. Jesus Christ, no matter what you've done, I don't care if you're the worst, rankest racist in the world, you are saved if you repent of your sins and put your trust in Jesus Christ. And that's it. It's as far as the east is from the west. There's true forgiveness, and Jesus Christ has paid for your sin. There's nothing left for you to do. But there's great condemnation in the social justice movement. So what does Christianity offer? Well, Christianity offers forgiveness of sins, unity in Christ, a fulfillment in your identity. There's more than just power relationships out there. Actually, the relationship between a husband and wife can be quite loving. And between a mother and a child and all these other relationships, they actually can be quite good if God's law is followed. Roles and responsibilities, social and political. Christianity gives you a purpose for those things. You're not just here in the here and now. There's an eternal realm to come. Christianity gives a basis for rights. They're tethered to responsibilities. We have the right to worship God and to fulfill the things he's called us to do. And then we have a sense of belonging because we know God's the one that's actually created cultures and people groups. That's what Acts 17 says. So all this fighting about cultures and skin colors and all these things, God actually is the one that loves true diversity because he created us. And he made us, and he puts you right where he wants you. And so you have a sense of belonging right in the middle of his plan. And that's what I would suggest the social justice movement does not offer. And that's what this generation is looking for. And they need to see it. They need to see it exemplified in us. They, especially college kids, they need to see it in people who are older than them, that there is a place that they can be fulfilled, that they can seek help if they when they have questions. I would suggest if any of you are wondering what you can do, and I've seen this work out quite well, get involved in your local communities. Not everyone can do everything, right? We have a human scale. We have limitations. But you can maybe get involved at the local college. I've seen, I've been involved in college ministry, I've seen where an older couple just opens up their homes. It's amazing how kids from broken families gravitate towards that. And they see a different way to live. I'll wrap it up with this. I remember a few years ago there was a monument being taken out of, it was in North Carolina, Chapel Hill, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And I remember on the news there was going to be this big sit-in. They were going to like sit there until the monument was taken out. And I thought, well, that means if they're not going to leave, they got to like listen to me preach the gospel, and they can't leave. And if they leave, you know, they lose. And if they stay, they get to hear me. Like, it's a lose-lose for them, I guess. So I went down there, and I brought a bunch of Gatorade, and I walked down there with the Gatorade, and they all thought I was with them. Like, I was, you know, down for the struggle or something. I said, hey, I brought you all a bunch of Gatorade, you know, where can I, who's in charge here? And they're like, oh, thank you so much, you know. And they pointed towards, you know, a bunch of pasty white kids protesting racism. And so I went and I sat with them and I gave them the Gatorade. And then I remember the moment it clicked in their minds when that I wasn't with them. And I asked them, I said, you know, I was wondering if you guys wouldn't mind going down the street. There's a Planned Parenthood. And I understand you want to protest things that happened like centuries ago, but there's actually like way more black babies being killed than white babies. And I thought maybe we could just go protest like a current injustice. And like everyone like looked at me and didn't know like what to say for a moment. So I was down there about 3 hours and there was professors coming out and just, I wasn't expecting the fanfare that developed from that. One of the things I learned though was this. The students who were coming out, I don't think they were against that statue. I think that was an excuse. They were upset at mom and dad. They were upset at grandma and grandpa. They had a problem with the way they were raised and the things that they think were abuses that incurred by them. And some of them didn't even have a conception of what a family was. And that came out in some of our conversations. And I can go into more detail about that if someone's curious, but we really drilled down and we talked about all the issues related to why they were there. We talked about Christianity. And I just remember thinking, sheep without a shepherd. They don't know. They don't know what they're stumbling over. And how beneficial would it have been, and I'm not blaming anyone, but how great would it have been if there were 10 Christians or 100 Christians or 1,000 Christians in an area that's in the Bible Belt that came out to be with these students, older couples, people forming relationships, inviting them into their home. I think that the way to stop hate, and this sounds social justice, but this is, I'm talking about true hate and true love. I think the way to stop hate like that is to show them love. And that's the way that I think God has, that's a great way that God has given us, to go and give them something that they're not expecting and they don't know what to do with, but it's something they need. And they're not going to find it in the movement they're part of. So that's my challenge, is try to get involved somewhere, wherever that is. Not everyone has all the time in the world, but even something small. Get involved in your school board or in the local town hall. You have a lot more influence in your local community than you do on a mass scale or even posting on Facebook. And I realize I feel like a hypocrite. I post on Facebook, and it's not wrong. But we have a lot more influence with the flesh and blood people around us. And so that's my call to action. And I hope that was informative for you. Do you want me to just close in prayer then? Or Father, thank you for this time. I know it's a lot of information, Father, and there's just so much going on, Lord. I know so many hearts are heavy. We're thinking of people that have fallen to this false religion, and we want to see them saved. We want to see them flourish the way that you want them to flourish, Lord, keeping your law involved in their communities, in their church, in their families. And I pray, Father, that you would do a work, even through the people in this room, the Christians who want to follow you and understand this, but not only understand it, Father, they want to change what's going on in their own lives and their own communities. And I pray that this would lead to productive discussions, Father, and that you would help us not to ever give up hope, because, Lord, you saved us while we were sinners. And there is never a time, Lord, we know that your grace, there's never a time your grace is impossible to find. It is out there, Lord, and you will find the people that you want to save. So, Lord, we pray for that. We love you. In Jesus' name, amen.